I was going to say that, say, in previous years at this retreat, I've tried to answer everybody's questions, and it's sometimes they've gone on really a long time. So this year I was going to try to maybe limit to about no more than an hour, because I think it goes on too long for people. Anyway, but this really, this is the first day, and there's a lot of questions already. It's sort of, it doesn't bode well at all. But anyway, I'll try to answer as many as I can, but I think I'll try to keep it limited. Equanimity. ... Your thoughts. Well, I can be equanimous with that. You know? Equanimity is a. There's a couple different ways to look at equanimity. One is the equanimity of as a Brahma-vihara. That's that loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, and so that's an exalted state, really, a quality of mind, heart that is very bright, steady, serene. So that's a quality to be cultivated, also as a bit more day to day level, equanimity as a quality that is based on. It's like having like in the chanting that we do on five subjects for frequent recollection. I am the nature to age, I've not gone beyond aging, I have the nature to sicken, I've not gone beyond sickness, I have the nature to die, I've not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So that contemplation on impermanence, and then the last one of I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. And also another kind of contemplating that in terms of all beings, so that recognizing that, and that's a basis of equanimity, where we can see for ourselves or for others, actions bring about results, and it's the we can have an evenness or an equanimity, a steadiness in the face of whether it's something incredibly pleasant and delightful or something that's difficult and painful. They have causes, so that we can come to a place of equanimity. Equanimity also is a is the final factor in factors, the seven factors of enlightenment. So that it's a When it has that kind of place, one can recognize the importance of equanimity as an internal factor of mind, that in order to really see clearly and penetrate, there needs to be this. And equanimity is especially when in all of these, in terms of relationship to our practice and how we relate to the world around us. It's a quality of brightness and steadiness, as opposed to indifference or whatever. That cultivation of equanimity is an important factor of the path. Please explain wise action. How can one see that it is not influenced by craving? By paying attention to results is a important criterion, and so that if it results in a sense of clarity, stability, happiness, well-being, peace, then it was probably wise action. Also with the... because sometimes it's hard to reflect on intention. It gets quite... sometimes the more we think about it, the more muddled we get. To pay attention to results, so that we can recognize, we can learn from our actions. Obviously, we want to be, say, not waiting for results all the time in order to figure out what wise action is. So that you're paying attention to, say, what are the indications of presence of craving in the mind, so that the presence of craving is inevitably going to create say an unwholesome, unskillful state of mind, akusala, and that has a distinctive characteristic in that the unwholesome or unskillful states of mind will have this sense of maybe agitation, restlessness, movement. It's not steady, it's not clear. Or it has a feeling of constriction, uncomfortable. The mind is not spacious, it's not peaceful. So that it will start to recognize the signs of the presence of craving within the mind, within the heart, so that gives us a sense of being able to say alarm bells to start going off and say, okay, there's I need to be careful around this. What the result might not be wise. This morning you talked about crossing the floods of obsessive thought by not holding on to or pushing them away. I get that, but it feels like there's something missing, a hole that needs to be filled up with something, a solution. yes, but oftentimes we leap on solutions, oftentimes without being willing to investigate what actually is a balance. Oftentimes we're looking for external solutions, external affirmation that somehow we've got the right solution, and we don't really pay attention to us within ourselves. What is the balance? What is a way where we're not not holding on, not pushing away. And it's kind of like I was saying, where we're looking for techniques, we're looking for methodologies, and that's what we feel we're missing. But it's usually the movement of mind is always moving out, looking for something out there that's going to make me secure, comfortable, sure that I've got the right technique, I've got the right method, I've got the solution. There it is, out there. And we don't really pay attention to what am I feeling, what am I experiencing, how can I balance this with my own mindfulness and discernment. So that gaining confidence in one's own awareness and wisdom, that usually scares the crap out of people. Give me something else. Tell me I'm doing it right. And the Buddhists are saying, no, you got to figure it out. You got to understand. You got to develop your wisdom. Okay, what should we do during eating? How do we eat with meditation? Go remember to chew your food well. I was still living in Thailand, the abbot of Wat Nanachan, and I took a group of monks to see the Supreme Patriarch of Thailand, and he was. I'd got to know him quite well. We used to. He really had a tremendous amount of respect for Ajahn Chah, and he's this venerable old monk who's the head of all the sangha. And you know, I think it was really boring for him to. To be an administrator, I think he missed talking Dhamma with people. You would have quite lovely conversations about practice with him, and I took the monks to pay respects, I remember him saying. He wanted to give us some advice for young monks, I said, just learn how to slow down and chew your food well. I know you young monks are always just pushing all the trying. It was really sweet. He said, yeah, you notice that all, older monks always end up with stomach problems. And it was just, human. It was quite wonderful. But that principle of slowing down, just paying attention to your body, what are you experiencing? Being present with them, because that that impulsion of the mind to get on to the next thing. I mean, just notice when you put food in your mouth, you got your food in your mouth, you're chewing. What are your eyes doing? I bet your eyes are looking for the next piece of food to get at. So, what am I going to get next? You know, so you haven't. Just simplifying it, coming back to that basic. This is a request. Could you please repeat the name of the sutta you mentioned this morning that lays out the whole spiritual path, the conversation with the devas. That is, I can't remember the name of it, but it is Samyutta, Samyutta, Samyutta Nikaya, 1, number 1. It's the very first discourse in a large collection of the connected discourses of the Buddha. It's like 5 books, but it's the very first one. So easy to find. What is the difference between piti and sukha, also equanimity and emptiness as a felt sense? Well, equanimity I just talked about, emptiness as a as a felt sense, particularly from the Theravada perspective, emptiness is a the emptiness of a sense of self, that I, me, mine agenda. That's what emptiness is pointing to. It's not a it's not a metaphysical. It's not emptiness in a metaphysical sense, which is something in later schools of Buddhism. There's, the doctrines of emptiness end up being somehow concretized or made into a metaphysical quality. But the Theravada scriptures, emptiness is the felt sense of not being pressed upon or driven by the self agenda. It's that ability to relinquish, put down, or not bring into being that whole the I, me, mine position. The difference between piti and sukha is, piti is joy, rapture. It's more of a emotional, or more emotionally centered, in the sense of. Where sukha is, of course, both. Obviously, it's emotion as well, but it's also more body, a felt sense within the body more. So that there's maybe piti is also maybe an elation. There's kind of an excitement there. Probably the best way of pointing to the difference of piti and sukha are commentarial description or example that is given by in the Visuddhimagga, and it's just illustrated by saying it's as if a person were walking through some kind of wilderness, kind of deserty type area, deserty type wilderness, and of course one's tired, one's thirsty, one's hungry, and not sure of the am I going to make it to the to some kind of safety, and then one sees somebody coming from the opposite direction, and they look like they're fresh, they're clean, they look kind of happy, and they say, "Yes, just over there is a kind of oasis, a forest, a pond, a small lake. There's water. There's food. There's place to rest. You're comfortable. There's other people there." And what arises is a sense of joy and kind of elation that, okay, I'm gonna make it. It's not far. I'll get there. And then one arrives at that place. One's able to bathe, to drink one's fill, to rest, and that is sukha. There's a happiness, but there's also a well-being, and it's felt within the body as well. Question. I volunteer in hospice and was in attendance for the passing of my parents. I notice vast differences in the way people experience their passage. What can we do while still alive to prepare for a peaceful and quote-unquote wakeful passing other than being present? Is there anything that can be a benefit to others? I think probably what's most beneficial to others is our own contemplation, investigation, acceptance of death, of our own mortality. That contemplation that I just mentioned, I am of the nature to age, I've not gone beyond aging, of the nature to sicken, I've not gone beyond sickness, I am of the nature to die, I've not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. To be willing to contemplate that on a regular basis. When I say regular, I don't mean sort of annually or biannually, but every day, many times a day, to bring that up, to contemplate, to reflect, and because the especially in terms of being a benefit to others is when we have a sense of acceptance and say lack of fear or intimidation of illness and death, so that when we ourselves are comfortable with death, with illness, and with the uncertainty of it, because just as this person says, yeah, they're just people experience it in so many different ways. Some people are, the whole process is different for everybody, in the sense the amount of comfort or discomfort, the amount of physical pain or not, how quickly the process goes, it's incredibly unpredictable. There is a certain template in the sense that we're going to die, it really does take all, all way, shapes and forms, and to not try to impose some kind of idea that you have of how it should go, either for oneself or for others, especially if they're loved ones. You really don't know. So that being able to be comfortable with uncertainty, being able to be comfortable with the emotional separation, emotional approach of death. That's our work that we can do. But it's also an incredible gift to others when you can be there for somebody and not get all weirded out. And also being comfortable with that's one of the things that there's a discourse where the Buddha, or maybe it's in the Vinaya, where the Buddha gives qualities of a good nurse, in the sense of, because that's as monastics, then that's part of our duties, is looking after each other when we're ill, and one of the qualities of say being a good nurse and nursing others who are ill is to not be upset or frightened or disgusted by different bodily fluids and what can come out of a human body. Being able to have that equanimity or acceptance. So a lot of it is dependent on our own being present or and reflecting, contemplating, understanding the nature of the human condition, and also when we do that, we really internalize it. Because the benefit that comes from that is tremendous compassion, so that we can be compassionate with others, and especially if they're not following the program that you've set for them or you expect of them, like they should be peaceful and clear and happy while they're dying, and they're not. I remember there was a a Western, a former monk who was asking Ajahn Chah about the benefits of helping dying people and hospice work. And Ajahn Chah was saying, yeah, you know, it's really a good thing to do, but you also have to recognize that if people aren't steady within themselves, you might not be able to help very much, really. If you think you're sort of going to come riding, you know, I mean, he didn't sort of say it like that. If you think you're going to come in with your sort of Buddhist hospice worker who's going to save people, he said, yeah, forget it. And then in Thailand, you have a tradition of when somebody is getting close to their death and as they're approaching their passing, and some family member or somebody will say, Buddho, Buddho, remind them to contemplate the Buddha, keep center, keep that quality, be the one who knows. And Ajahn Chah sort of said, as somebody's approaching death, you're sort of saying, he took his cane and he just pushed him in the chest and pushed him down on the floor and said, oh, Buddho, Buddho, how's it feel now, it can be overwhelming. So that, and that's why it's so important to say for ourselves to really, if we want to benefit others, we really have to contemplate ourselves, bring it into ourselves, so that we're familiar, comfortable with this natural process of aging, sickness, death, and recognize the uncertainty of that. But also when there is an ease with death and the death process, and illness and the illness process, then people can it is a real gift to people, because then they can shed their own fears, because it's a pretty, I mean, that's about as vulnerable as you'll ever get. So that to be able to help people be at ease, it is a great gift. Okay, there's a request. Will you tell us again the name of the sutta you spoke of last night in today's Dhamma talk? Name and location. It was... it's the Aniruddha Sutta, Anguttara 8. You wrote it down. What was it? 30. Yes, Anguttara 8, number 30. So Anguttara are the numerical discourses. What is the best approach to deal with guilt? Just don't do it. But It really is a curious phenomenon. It's so pervasive in our culture. To be able to really recognize it as something that is really an aberration of the human condition. We take something that we've done unskillfully. And it doesn't even with guilt. It doesn't even have to be. That's not necessarily even the case. You can feel guilty about good things you do. But taking something and then feeling bad about it and then dwelling on that and then returning to it over and over. As an approach to recognize that, because the Buddha, there's a place for remorse in Buddhism, that we recognize the say unskillfulness that we've done, and then learn from that and determine not to repeat that. The tendency of guilt is to revisit it over and over again and keep coming back to it and sustaining painful feelings around it. So that trying to shift the tendency to review something that has been unskillful and that one feels that one carries as a burden of guilt, to shift it as to something that one can learn from and create a sense of confidence in. And say, because we can learn from our mistakes. That's the benefit of having a human mind that's able to reflect on itself. Doing that, then we can step beyond and put down the. A lot of it is also around the sense of identity that we carry, because we then identify with certain actions and think that's who I am. And so the things that they do or say, but that's on a certain level. I mean, it's also the beauty of the Buddha's teaching on non-self is that there isn't anything that is a permanent solid identity. This isn't who we are. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. These are actions of body, speech, and mind that we can either learn from and understand, or they can trip us up and create more suffering. But they're not a solid identity or solid entity within us. Because I think that's what where that feeling of guilt comes, is that somehow it's solid and is a there's a continuity of being within that, and that's one of the, just on a very mundane level, kind of freedom that contemplation of not self is, that when we looking at body, feeling, say pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, memory, association, perception, thoughts, whether they're intelligent thoughts, not intelligent thoughts, you know, wise thoughts, not wise thoughts, emotion, and then consciousness. These are we can relinquish. It's not that we can they're not self. They can be put down. They can be set aside. The identity with it can be set aside because it's not, say, not who we truly are. What's that phrase? Is you were that sutta that you were pointing to?
Whatever is not yours, abandon it.
Yes,
what
right.
Is it that's not yours?
A very simple sutta that the Buddha gives as encouragement, you know, whatever is not yours, abandon it. And what is not yours? Body is not yours. Feeling is not yours. Perception is not yours. Mental formations are not yours. Consciousness is not yours. Abandon it. Whatever is not yours, abandon it. So just that very simple injunction. It frees up a lot of well-being and happiness. For those of us who need to routinely rest more due to aging, illness, or disability, could you share some suggestions and advice for how to optimize this time as meditation in a lying down posture? I think one of the things, especially with when because of aging or illness or some kind of disability at the time, then it actually takes a determination to use that lying down posture for meditation or for contemplation, because the associations that we build up over a lifetime, or you know, so as soon as you lie down, it's, oh, I can fall asleep now, or I can, it's my time to zone out, and so one has to consciously bring to mind this is another meditation posture, and to bring awareness to the body in the same way that as I was giving instructions this morning in the sitting posture, when one's lying down, to pay attention to a sense of a balance and symmetry, as one's lying down. Because that helps to bring out, there's a certain balance and symmetry, rather than just sort of kind of figuratively slumping into a lying down posture. There's just going through the body and bringing about a certain kind of symmetry and balance as one's lying down. And that brings an alertness to the body. Using the breath in a way that really fully breathing into the abdomen, so that there's kind of enlivens the posture. Especially if one has to use the lying down posture, then it doesn't really matter what posture you're in, like whether you're sitting, lying, standing, or walking. If you have to do it for a longer period of time than you're used to, it's uncomfortable. It's just the nature of having a human body. So that even, say, lying down, you think, wow, I can do lying down. And then everything would be fine. But it's as long as you're not shifting position, then there's some discomfort that the body feels. So that learning how to stick with the posture, even as it gets a bit uncomfortable. I mean, again, even say you might be lying on your back and getting that paying attention to symmetry and relaxing into it. But then, it won't. There'll be a period of time where it's comfortable, and then it'll get uncomfortable. So then shifting into, say, lying on the one's right-hand side is one that the Buddha recommends over and over again, lying on the right side. And especially if you have to lie down for extended periods of time, then it you want to, if you're lying on your side, then you can't just sort of be like sometimes you see some of the Buddha images are made of the Buddha in a reclining posture, and it's sort of just absolutely sort of pencil straight. Well, that doesn't really work. sort of feet on top of each other like this, and everything's absolutely. You could line it up. You have to you fold your knees a bit. Oftentimes, I had to develop the lying down posture as a meditation because it was years and years ago when I was injured with a fractured pelvis. That cramps your style as a sort of a meditator. it was my right pelvis, so I couldn't do it on the right, so I had to be on the left. You have to bend your knees a little bit, and then use using a pillow to prop the head up a bit, so that you could just keep, and you could hold that posture for quite some time. But yeah, there's you need some props with the lying down posture. And I think one that really doesn't work very well is lying on one's stomach. I mean, it's not a very mindful posture. But even that, if there was some reason for injury or something, then I can remember years ago there was a friend of mine who had spinal surgery, and he spent a long time. There wasn't much option. He was on his stomach. But I think if you got the options, then lying on one side, lying on one's back, you can develop them. And a lot of it is relaxing into the posture and keeping an alertness and going through the body. In the same way that I spoke this morning, if you're sitting in meditation and taking awareness, you're breathing, and then going from the top of the head around the eyes, paying attention to different points through the body. There's an alertness and awareness that naturally comes, as well as an ease. So that the same thing is possible with the reclining posture. It can be a posture of both, say, relaxation, resting, as well as alertness and attention. It's not impossible, and so a lot of it is. But a lot of it is also that changing the perception that one has, in the sense of oftentimes that perception of resting as and lying down is when I get to rest and zone out. But the thing doesn't really matter what posture. Each posture is a posture for mindfulness and alertness.